Welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. If you're passionate about mastering self-leadership, then you're in the right place. I have always been curious about and fascinated by the pursuit of leadership excellence. This is why I pursued my PhD in psychology with a specialization in business, and I've continued to dedicate my career to understanding the science and practice of positive leadership. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm a best-selling author, award-winning keynote speaker, executive coach, and member of the Forbes Coaches Council. Each week, I'll bring you world-class content on the science and practice of positive leadership. Through my conversations with best-selling authors, TED speakers, and top CEOs, you'll be able to leverage their insights and experience so you can maximize your potential and be the leader the world needs you to be.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well VIP webinar series. Really excited to relaunch this forum, and the response to this webinar has been absolutely fantastic. I'm really pleased to restart this process. And for those of you who are return visitors, which I saw in terms of the sign-up sheet, welcome back. Fabulous to have you. For those of you who are new, welcome. Really thrilled that you can be a part of this. And the primary purpose of these webinars essentially is to build a community of practice. I have the privilege in my work of interviewing best-selling authors, TED speakers, the leading international experts in various areas. And so love to be able to share their content with you and then also provide an opportunity for an interactive conversation. And so there's so much great work that's done. And I have to say, I'm thrilled today to be able to welcome Dr. Teresa Mabile from Harvard and the author of the Progress Principle to the webinar this afternoon. And she and I are going to be talking about all of the fantastic research that is behind her book, all of the great work that she's been doing. And I've got my own copy. So this is a fabulous read. So welcome, Teresa, to the webinar.
Thank you so much, Craig. I'm delighted to be here. Hello, everyone.
I thought it was awesome when I first reached out. I was calling it the Progress Principle. We're talking about how differently across border, it's in the U.S., it's progress. And in Canada, it's progress, or we will say that, or interchange. So
yes, yes. And I will probably just be able to do progress, but I think we can understand each other just as well.
Exactly. And I may fall into progress, so which will be great. I'll be mindful of my answer. So the other thing I wanted to share about the book, again, it's a fantastic read. It's based on research that you've done. And what I love is there was over 12,000 diary entries that you and your team examined, which I think is just absolutely phenomenal. And it was honored as the breakthrough idea from Harvard Business Review, which again, gives you a really strong sense of how powerful and important these findings are. So I'd love to start with, so what motivated you to do this research and write this book? And can you unpack for our readers what the research involved? I talked about it at a high level, but I think it's just so compelling.
Oh, I'll try to keep this brief. I've been studying creativity for virtually my entire career, and that's over 40 years. I had discovered through research that I had done inside organizations that people's creativity and the overall innovativeness of teams and, in fact, of organizations depended importantly on the organizational culture, on the work environment that people found themselves in, especially people who are charged with doing the most creative and innovative work inside the organization. I did a lot of research on R&D scientists and technicians, for example, people creating the company's new products, but I also worked in other functions as well. All of those discoveries that I'd made earlier were kind of at the 30,000 foot level, where we had a sense of the landscape that, for example, supervisory support was important for creativity and innovation. Group support, work group support was important. Higher level management, encouragement of creativity and innovation. But I was frustrated because I didn't know from an on-the-ground view, microscopically, day by day, what is it that supervisors say and do? What is it that that high-level organizational leaders say and do, or teammates, that can strongly influence how people perceive the work environment that they're in, that water that they're swimming in every day, the way that they're emotionally influenced by it, and very importantly, how their motivation might be influenced by it. And we have found that all of those can matter for how creative people are going to be in their work. So I wanted to get that day by day, up close, in the trenches view of what it's like to try to do creative work as the thing you're supposed to be doing every day, what helps and what hinders. So for that reason, I decided, boy, the best way to, short of standing by someone and watching them while they're working, and in fact, that wouldn't even really give me access to that inner psychological experience. The best way to do it, I decided, was to collect confidential daily electronic diaries from people day after day during the entire course of a creative project that they were working on. What I mean by that is a project that was supposed to end up with a creative solution or a creative new process or product or solve a complex client problem. I realized that if we followed enough teams doing projects like that, some of them would work out well, some of them would end up with creative solutions, and some of them, the individuals would be creative more often than not creative, they would do good work, and we would be able to see what might have facilitated that. I also assumed that if we studied enough projects, we find that some of them did not work out so well, and that people weren't able to produce the level of creativity that was expected and was hoped for by their organization. So we figured if we followed them in real time, we'd be able to get that clear sense of what it is managers can do, what it is colleagues can do for each other, and what it is organizational leaders can do and what they should avoid doing as well. So that's why we recruited 7 companies in 3 different industries to participate in this study. We asked these companies if they would allow us to come in and try to recruit teams from within their company among the teams that were charged with doing the cutting edge work of the organization, the most creative and innovative work. And we were able to recruit 26 project teams. We did ask people to participate as individuals, but we also wanted to know what was going on in a team from multiple people's perspectives. So we asked people during the entire course of their project, and these were on average 4 to 5 months long, these projects, Monday through Friday. We sent them in their email electronic diary form. It was the same every day. And we asked them to fill it out toward the end of the workday. And we stressed that this was voluntary participation on their part. About half the teams that we recruited ended up deciding, you know, we want to do this because I promised them a workshop afterwards, a half-day workshop, where I would show them, look, this is what we saw going on in your team. This is what seemed to help your work go better, and this is what seemed to hinder your work. And they actually did find those workshops fascinating. So I think that's what kept them going. We got an amazing 75% response rate. So out of the 16,000 diaries we sent to the 238 professionals in these project teams, we got back nearly 12,000 individual daily diary entries, as you said before.
That's incredible. Well, and what I love about it is that it's, so a couple of things, you know, that you went into the inside, you know, really got into the inner thinking. And it's such a strong evidence base from which to base the conclusions. And it's so fascinating. So I'm really excited we're going to talk about it. And I should mention as well, you've done so much extraordinary, groundbreaking work on creativity and motivation. We could talk for hours and hours. Throughout my PhD, I was referencing your work constantly. So this is a special treat for me. So you talked about in the book, the 3 components of our inner work life, which I really loved. So can you talk about what they are and why they're so important?
Yeah, this is the everyday psychological experience that I said we wanted to grab onto, we wanted to x-ray or take the temperature of, if you will. That is one of the things that we had on this daily diary form. We had little 7-point scales where we asked people, today at work, describe your feelings and your thoughts. And we had a number of questions about emotion, which is one component of what we call inner work life. That's simply your emotional reactions to what's going on. Could be positive, negative, could be, of course, intense or very mild, very moderate reactions. It can also be kind of your overall mood on a given day. So that's one component, emotions. Another is perceptions. And that's just your thoughts, your judgments about what's happening and what it means, the sense making that you try to do about the events going on at work or going on in your own work. The third component of inner work life, which to me in some ways is the most important, is motivation. That's your drive to do what you're doing, what keeps you going in your work day by day. We focus in particular on intrinsic motivation, and that's the motivation to do something because the work itself is interesting, satisfying, compelling in some way, personally challenging maybe. Doesn't mean it's fun necessarily, but it's something that you are really passionately interested in, or at least moderately interested in. So intrinsic motivation is what we focus on. But we did every day have some scale ratings of extrinsic motivation as well. To what extent did you feel motivated by recognition, by the rewards you could earn in your work, by doing better than other people? Those are all extrinsic motivators. And so we had some scales looking at that every day, but we also had scales on to what extent were you motivated by your interest in the work today? We asked about emotional state. To what extent did you feel happy today? To what extent did you feel frustrated? And so on. And we had scales that rated their perceptions of the workplace. To what extent did you feel that you had autonomy or freedom in your work? To what extent did you feel time pressure while you were working? It took people maybe 2 minutes to fill out those scales. They were the same every day, so they came to know what to expect. Right? We just click on your answer. To me, the most interesting question on the daily diary was open-ended. We asked people, briefly describe one event that occurred today that stands out in your mind. It can be anything at all, as long as it's relevant to your work or this project. We told them when we trained these teams, and we had an in-person training with each of the teams, so we were flying all over the country, my research associates and I. We trained them to talk about a specific event that actually occurred that day, to tell us, you know, what happened, who was involved, in as much concrete detail as they could. And one of the things we wanted to do was to triangulate across different people on the team, each of whom was, you know, making their own individual private response to the diary question. But we also wanted to get at what was really happening. And the only way we could do that is if they gave us really good reports. So that was a day that we had. And we believe that inner psychological state, inner work life, was likely to be at least an important predictor of how people's work would go day by day and month by month and throughout the project overall. It turns out that they really were very important. And would you like me to speak to the main result we got about inner work life?
Yeah, I think that's a great next step. I was about to ask, so this is fabulous. Yeah, great segue.
In addition to these diaries, we had a ton of other data. We had data on the projects themselves. Of course, we had a lot of data on the companies. We had data on the team's functioning from people on the team themselves. They filled a lot of questionnaires for us. We knew their personalities, which is interesting. We gave them all personality inventories. We gave them motivational orientation inventories. So a lot of different aspects of their traits, their psychology as individuals, but also a lot of about the team functioning and so on. But the most important other source of data was separate ratings of the creativity of each of the individuals working on that team. So we had supervisors and close colleagues of each of these 238 people in these 7 different companies. We had supervisors and close colleagues rate them monthly. To what extent did this individual make creative contributions to the project over the previous month? To what extent were they productive? That is, did they do technically good work? To what extent were they good colleagues to the others on the team? And to what extent did they demonstrate commitment to the work? So we actually had 4 performance measures. One was creativity, the primary thing we're interested in, but we had other aspects of performance as well. And when we analyzed those performance measures against inner work life that each individual was feeling, we made our first big discovery. We call it the inner work life effect. And that is that each aspect of inner work life, emotions, perceptions, and motivation, significantly predicts not only creativity, but also product commitment and collegiality. So on those days and those weeks and those months when people were having the most positive perceptions of their work environment, their team, the work, even themselves, when they were feeling the strongest, most pleasant, positive emotions, and when they were feeling most jazzed about their work, when they were feeling the strongest intrinsic motivation, that is when they turned out work that was not only more creative, but also more productive. They demonstrated more commitment to their work, and they were better colleagues to each other, which, by the way, raises everyone else's level of performance. So that was a very exciting finding. And I just have to tell you one little additional finding. Because we had day-by-day data, we were able to do lagged analyses, and we found that when people were experiencing more positive emotions on one day, not only were they more likely to come up with a creative idea or solve a complex problem creatively that day, they were also more likely to do it the next day, regardless of the next day's emotions. So that's really interesting. That suggests that there's some kind of an incubation effect that can get going. That when people are in that positive inner work-life state, that carryover effect, it can result in a creative idea that day, or it can even cook overnight and end up in a creative idea the next day. So to the extent that you can have those positive inner work-life experiences going and keep them going, you're more likely to have chain reactions of high-level creativity, productivity, and so on.
That's amazing. Well, and it's funny because someone here clearly has been a fan or of your work and looked and talked about, like, really enjoyed the finding of that linkage between happiness and how it boosts creativity. So what is it about those positive emotions that tend to spurn that creative thought? And I love how it's not just in the moment, it's a continuous compounding effect.
Well, I cannot claim that I know the deepest answer to that, but we've got some hints from the work that we've done and from the work that other psychologists have done as well. I think that ultimately the answer to that question is going to depend on neuropsychological studies as well as social, psychological, and organizational psychological studies. But it looks like what happens when people are in that positive inner work-life state is that they think more expansively. There's a psychologist named Barbara Fredrickson who has a theory that she calls broaden and build. And she says that when people are in a positive emotional state, their cognition gets broader. That is, they don't categorize things as narrowly as they normally would. And they build on one thought, builds on the other in a much more expansive fashion than when people are in a negative or even a neutral emotional state. We think that that fits with what we saw. People were making associations that they might not ordinarily make, cognitive associations, when they were in those more positive inner work-life states. And we think that that's probably at least part of the story.
Well, thank you, Tara, for an awesome question. It's really good. And a fantastic, fantastic insight into that and something that we see. And so thank you, Teresa, for your expertise. And so I guess fundamentally, we're here to talk about the progress principle. So what is the progress principle? So, and can you share with us why progress and setbacks are so important? Empower.
Yeah. Well, so that's our second big finding. And it is what we consider the really big finding of the book. That's why we call the book The Progress Principle. We thought, all right, we now know that when people are in a better inner work-life state, they're more likely to produce better work. What is it that leads to that better inner work-life state? And for that, we went back into the diaries. And we analyzed those 12,000 stories that people told us about their days. Remember, briefly describe one event that occurred today. We categorized every single event that occurred. We had a very complex coding system. I think it had about 80 different types of events in it. We wanted to be comprehensive in categorizing the types of events. And then we analyzed them so that we went in and chose the best inner work-life days that people had and the worst inner work-life day. So for everybody in the study, we said, all right, let's pick their best inner work-life day and their worst in terms of the emotions, perceptions, and motivation, intrinsic motivation that they were experiencing on those days. And we knew this because we had at least on average, we had about 50 days worth of data from each individual. So we went in and analyzed what was going on those best inner work-life days. Were there certain kinds of events that seemed to occur with much greater frequency on those great inner work-life days? And we found that there were a few kinds of events. But of all of those, there was one type that stood out way above the others in terms of its prominence on those best inner work-life days. And that was simply making progress in meaningful work, moving forward in something that you think is meaningful. So that second part is really important. It can't be work that you find mindless or trivial, or you have no idea why you're doing it. And I know, Craig, that this is really important to you in the work that you are doing and in your own book, the sense of purpose and direction that people have in their work, that sense that they are contributing to something that matters. If people have that sense about their work, and fortunately, most of these 238 people, most of the time, thought that what they were doing was important. They realized that they were on pretty elite teams. They were creating the new products for this company or the new processes or solving the most complex problems. But on those days that they didn't feel that their work was meaningful, interestingly, it didn't really matter how much progress they made. That didn't give the boost to inner work life that we saw when they felt that, okay, this is the important stuff that I'm doing here. You're nodding your head like crazy. So I assume that this fits very well with your own work, I assume.
For sure. And what I love about the subtitle is where you make a point to say using small wins. Because I think that to me was just, there's so many great findings in the book and in your research. I love that element of small wins. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, I was going to ask you if I could do that next.
Because
that's an important corollary to the progress principle. Yes. It doesn't have to be huge breakthroughs. The progress principle applies even when people are making steps forward that to us, as outsiders at least, and in some sense to them, maybe trivial, not that big a thing, but it is making progress on something that they care about. Can I read you one of my very favorite diary stories? So this is from one of our information technology teams. We had five information technology teams of the 26 teams in the study. This is from a programmer that we call Tom. He was working on a really complex program for one of the company's most important clients. And he had been struggling with a bug in the software that he had not been able to identify. And he talked about this, I think, on Monday of the given week, and he talked about it again on Tuesday. And he was really frustrated. And he said this the day that he finally solved the problem. He said, I smashed that bug that's been frustrating me for almost a calendar week. That may not be an event to you, but I live a very drab life, so I'm all hyped. No one really knows about it. Three of the team members who would be involved are out today. So I have to sit here rejoicing in my solitary smugness. There are a few different things that I love about that quote. One is, of course, that Tom doesn't just tell us, I felt good today and I solved a problem today. He shows us the causality. He says, I felt good because I solved a problem today. So right there, the whole thing is demonstrated. Another thing that's interesting about this is it was just a bug. In the grand scheme of Tom's career, even in the grand scheme of this project, it was no big deal. But the thing is, it was a big deal to him on the day that it happened. And that's the power of small wins. That's kind of good news, I think, for managers, because it means that you don't have to wait for those huge breakthroughs. People can experience this positive inner work-life effect day by day if they meet even more minor milestones. Unfortunately, I have to say, there is a dark side to the progress principle. And I want to talk about that for a minute. You mentioned setbacks.
Yes.
We found of all the negative events that occurred on people's worst inner work life days, the single most prominent by far was setbacks in the work. And that's feeling like you're stalled, or maybe you're blocked somehow in moving forward on this work, or maybe you're even moving backwards. When people had the setbacks in their work, their inner work life was notably worse. And setbacks were, in fact, the most prominent event on people's worst inner work life days, kind of the mirror image of progress on the best days. By far, those pairs of events are the single most important differentiators between people's best and worst inner work life days in terms of how they feel and in terms of the work that they produce. I have to insert another finding here. Negative events, these negative events can be real killers. We found, and this isn't just our research, this is kind of a general finding in psychology, that bad is stronger than good, that the setback events had a negative effect on inner work life that was 3 to 4 times stronger than the positive effect of progress. Three to four times stronger. And so there are a few important implications here. One is you really do have to sweat the small stuff. If you're a manager, if you're a colleague who's trying to support the work of your team, and I think if you're a higher level leader too, when you're talking about how you deal with your subordinates, your immediate, your direct reports, you do have to sweat the small stuff. And you especially have to be on the lookout for things that are impeding progress, because those, if they lead to setbacks, can really undermine inner work life and can lead to these death spirals where people are not having positive inner work life. That impedes their ability to do really creative and productive work. And that in turn makes them feel worse because they're not getting that the positive outcome of the progress principle. And their inner work life is even worse. And that makes it even more difficult for them to make progress on the work and be creative. So you want to get a positive spiral going rather than this death spiral. And the positive spiral is, okay, we got to recognize there are always going to be setbacks. If you're doing those important work of your organization, if you are the innovators, innovation is all about trial and error, moving forward, then you move backward, then you move forward again. That's the nature of doing really important creative work. But what you need to do is make sure that that ratio of positive events, progress events to setbacks is a good ratio. You want to have more of those progress events. And our best teams had a lot of setbacks. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But they had more progress events. And that's what's key. You have to facilitate progress.
And I have to say, like in my coaching work with executives, that finding in combination, the power of small wins, as you talk about in the research, and then as well being aware of the setbacks, it's such a transformative idea around how to manage their work and the work of the people they lead. And I think it just has so many great impacts personally and then collectively in the organization. Another thing that I thought was fascinating is that you mentioned in the book that you surveyed hundreds of managers, CEOs, 95% of them misunderstood what truly motivated people, and in particular, in terms of the power of progress. So what leads to that blind spot? I think it's just such a intriguing finding, and I'd love to get your thoughts on it.
I have to tell you something funny that it didn't seem funny at the time that motivated us to do this survey. When we first made this discovery of the progress principle and how important progress events were in motivating people and keeping them engaged in their work every day, we started talking to managers about it. I have the opportunity at Harvard Business School to talk with many executives. Of course, I do consulting inside companies. And when I told people about this result that I was so excited about, they weren't that excited. They said, oh, sure. It's obvious. Of course, people feel good when they make progress in work. That's, you know, it's no big deal. And I thought, really? Is it obvious? I didn't think it was, because I could tell from reading these 12,000 diaries, and I read them all many times, I could tell that these managers did not act like the managers of these teams did not act like they understood how important progress was. Most of them didn't. Of the 26 teams, we had five teams where those team leaders, the immediate supervisors of those teams, really got it. They understood how important progress was, and they supported it consistently. So we wanted to do the survey, and we just sent a simple question to nearly 700 managers and high-level leaders from a variety of companies from all around the world. We asked them, all right, here's a list of five employee motivators. Rank order them in terms of how important you think they are. And we had a list of five things that all are motivators. We had things like recognition and reward or incentives. Of course, we had progress on the list because we know that that's the most important motivator day by day. And we had some other employee motivators too. So we just asked them to make the rankings. We got the data back and it blew us away because progress was not ranked first. Do you remember from the book what was ranked first?
Oh, that's a good, no, I don't.
Recognition.
That's, I was going to say recognize. Yeah, that was going to be my guess. Recognition. Neat.
Yeah, recognition was ranked first. Interpersonal support was ranked next. That is a motivator. That was ranked next. And then I think clear goals in the work or incentives was third, and then clear goals. Progress was ranked dead last. Fifth out of five. And the astonishing thing was only 5% of managers got that right. Only 5% of these people we surveyed ranked progress number one. And yet we know from our research that not only is it number one, it's number one by a mile. Right. That's not a small finding. If they had been making their rankings completely randomly, what percent would have chosen progress? 20% should have chosen progress if they were completely just doing this randomly. So it's like they were actively selecting against progress. And I have to say, fortunately, that is kind of how most of the managers of these teams that we studied, that's how they were operating day by day. They were kind of ignoring when their teams were making progress and what they might be able to do to help facilitate progress.
So someone else has read the book. So this is great. Love the book. This is from Anne. So Anne said, you know, I love the nourishment factor or the power of interpersonal support. So can you share some of the concrete ways that leaders can leverage this and how we can leverage this in terms of our own supporting our own inner life and our work life?
Yeah. And thank you very much for that question. Was it Tara who asked the earlier question?
Yeah, I asked
that question as well. There are ways that we as leaders, as managers, can directly nourish inner work life. Not complicated at all. The first one is basic respect and recognition for individuals, for the value that individuals bring to the work, to the workplace. It's not complicated. It doesn't have to be big public recognition. It can be in private saying, hey, I really appreciate your work on this aspect of the project this week. It really made a difference. Or, you know, expressing support for help that someone gave to a teammate or somebody who was struggling. That goes a long way. Just that basic respect. And we saw really unbelievable instances of disrespect in the worst. There was one of those seven companies was just so bad. It had a toxic work environment. I have to say, we chose only companies that outwardly looked very successful when we began our study. When we got inside them, we sometimes saw something different from the external perception of the companies. You know, they were all financially successful. They were all viewed as innovators in their industry. This worst company, they basically went out of business within 3 years of our concluding our study. When we were in there doing this microscopic study of everyday work life, what we saw really made us cringe. And we worried about what would happen with the company, and it came true. So respect and recognition was completely lacking at that company. I mean, managers were just out and out disrespecting people, often in public, which was terrible. The second nourisher is encouragement. When the work difficult, just expressing confidence in people that they can do it, You hope that they'll persevere, that they'll keep at it. That encouragement, again, go a long way. The third nourisher is emotional support. This does not mean it has to be a warm and fuzzy work environment where people are hugging and singing kumbaya all the time, or that people are crying on each other's shoulders constantly. It does need to be a workplace where people feel that they can share with the supervisor, with teammates, if they're having some real difficulty in their personal life or their professional life. It's great. Not even necessary, really, to be able to, even if there's nothing you can do to help, to just say, look, I know you're going through a tough time right now. How are you doing? To check in with somebody who's shared with you that they're having difficulties. One of the best inner work-life teams we studied was in a chemicals company, a team of all men, not the environment where you'd expect a lot of warm fuzziness, but we saw incredible inner work life in among this team. And it was because the team leader was open to that kind of emotional support. One of his teammates was going through a lot of trouble. His wife was in chemotherapy for cancer. And he just, you know, once every week or two when he was chatting with this colleague, he would say, hey, you know, how's it going with your wife? How are things going at home? And in his diary, that guy reported how much it meant to him. That team leader just said, hey, I know things are tough. How's it going for you? You know, the team leader couldn't fix the situation, but that emotional support made a huge difference and allowed that guy to feel, I'm supported here. This is a place where I can really engage. This is a place where I feel like I want to be. Mm-hmm. And the fourth nourisher is camaraderie. Giving people the opportunity, you know, when they're working closer together, give them the opportunity to know each other as human beings a little bit. You don't have to have happy hour every Friday, but at least give people occasional opportunities to be together informally, to develop a sense of enjoyment of each other as people, a sense of trust in each other, and appreciating each other as human beings. So that was a great question, Anne. Thank you so much. And of course, there are things that managers can also do to support progress directly. Mm-hmm. And we call those the catalysts. And I don't know if you want to go there next, Craig.
Yes, I think that was my next question. So I think that's great. It's a wonderful connective.
You know, big question is, what can you do to support progress? If it's so important, and boy, it is, what can you do? This is going to sound like management 101, but that's good news, I think. It's not exotic. Right. Measures that team leaders and colleagues have to take. The first, most important catalyst in some ways, because it's foundational, is clear goals in meaningful work.
Yeah.
People need to know what it is they're trying to accomplish. They need to all be on the same page, and they need to understand why it matters. Why is this important for this division of the company? Why is it important for the company? Why is it important for the customers? Why is it important for the community? Why is it important maybe for the world, for society in general? Depending on what it is you're doing, you can find that meaningfulness somewhere so that each individual can connect what they're doing to something that matters. So clear goals, we know where we're going. The second catalyst is autonomy. Might seem like it's a little bit in opposition to clear goals, but people need to have the autonomy to decide how to carry out the work, how to reach those goals. So when you put those first two catalysts together, it's like people need to understand this is the mountain that we're trying to climb, but they also need to feel that they get to decide how to climb it. When people have that sense of autonomy, that freedom, they're going to engage a lot more deeply, and they're going to be more likely to make progress in the work, because no one understands this particular problem better than the people working on that problem or the experts that they bring in. Another catalyst, sounds incredibly simple, is help. Help with the work, especially, you know, when it gets really difficult, when there's an obstacle, maybe it's a technical obstacle of some kind, being able to step in and either yourself directly help the individual or team that's having that difficulty, or find expertise that can help with that problem. Mm-hmm. Sometimes help is in the form of just gathering information. The next catalyst is often related to this, and that's sufficient resources. People need sufficient resources to do their work if they're going to be creative in the work. You don't want them to have to spend all their time being creative and figuring out how to get the minimal resources they need. You want them to be creative on the problem that they're trying to solve. So I don't mean lavish resources. In fact, too many resources and too many people on a project can kill it, but sufficient resources to get the work done. And next is sufficient time, but not too much. Interestingly, you want to have a balance here. So there needs to be some sense of urgency. And there generally is in important projects that are going on inside companies. This is important work, and there is an urgent need for it, but not so much time pressure that people have no time to explore for those better solutions, those more creative solutions, those novel ideas that can really move things to the next quantum level in terms of innovativeness. And you want to have a work environment where people feel that there's an openness to new ideas. There's a great idea flow within the organization. Not that every idea has to be accepted. No. But that every idea has to be respected enough to get a fair hearing. And finally, I'm going to mention a catalyst that is, I think, the most difficult for most managers and yet one of the most important. And that is having an atmosphere where people feel they can learn from mistakes and problems and setbacks, as well as from successes. Our natural human tendency too often, if something goes wrong, is to sweep it under the rug, ignore it, or to castigate the person who is responsible for it. But the most adaptive response by far, especially in an organizational environment, is to say, all right, let's figure out what went wrong here and how we can learn from it. What happened? Let's do a debrief and figure out, you know, how we can move forward from this. That the best company in our study, the one that is still successful many years after we collected the data, still the innovative leader of its company, boy, they had that atmosphere figured out. Every team, if there was a mistake or if there was an experiment that went horribly wrong and nobody could figure out why, you know, there was no blame was cast. It was, all right, let's talk about it. Let's do an immediate debrief. What can we learn from this? So people weren't afraid to take risks. They weren't afraid to try something new, go out on a limb. They weren't afraid to offer an idea that might sound crazy at first because they had a sense of psychological safety.
Well, and what I love about that is it's an idea that transcends time and it's continually relevant because one of the words you hear all the time now is we need to be iterative. We have to get out, iterate. And then how do you do that without getting comfortable with failure, with putting things out, learning, seeing how it works out, learn from it, adjust, move on. And as you say, it's such a powerful element, particularly as well as the psychological safety side. It is so invaluable, and yet it can be challenging for organizations and its leaders to accept.
I, at this point, recommend to our listeners that they look at the research conducted by and the books written by my colleague at Harvard Business School, Amy Edmondson.
Yes.
Edmondson is the premier researcher currently on psychological safety. She's done the most important work in that area, and she has shown how to apply it in teams and in organizations. And you know what? I think it's a great principle that we can apply in our personal lives to our family dynamics. To our community groups as well. So please take a look at Professor Edmondson's work.
I agree. It's transformative and it is fantastic, leading edge, and it's been a focus for so many years. I think it's just so many invaluable lessons within it. And I'm mindful of time has flown. We've got about 10 minutes left. So I want to add a couple of final questions because this has just been great. You've consulted with the top organizations in the world. So I'd love to hear, so what are some of the findings that audiences find most difficult to accept and or challenge on, and how do you maneuver them? Because I get asked that as well, right? Hey, there's this great research and then organizations are resistant. So I'd be curious your experience about where do people push back and how do you shift them around?
All right, let me just say, I'm not sure how successful I am at shifting people around, but The pushback that I get, I think most often, is a sense from managers, either, you know, line level, immediate supervisors of small teams, all the way up to the executive suite, is not deeply believing that managers really do bear a lot of responsibility for the work progress that their people make and for the inner work life that people are experiencing as they go about their work every day. It seems like, okay, people have work. They're supposed to do it. They're supposed to make progress on their work. What does that have to do with me? It has a lot to do with you, because people do need those clear goals. They really do need those resources. They do need the sufficient time and the idea flow and the psychological safety. What you do as a manager and what you fail to do has a huge impact on inner work life, even of very senior people in your organization, people who have been there for years. Don't ignore that. And, you know, I suggest to managers that to keep it top of mind, you need to give yourself some supports. Management is tough. It's really a difficult job. I don't know if you're familiar, Craig, with the book by Atul Gawande called The Checklist Manifesto. You read it? Yeah. And I'm sure that many of our audience has as well. That book is amazing. It's by a surgeon who did research several years ago trying to understand what could be done to reduce the incidence of really awful complications and even death following surgery due to accidents, things that go wrong in surgery that should not go wrong. They came up with a very simple procedure, actually inspired by what the airline industry has done to try to make flying safer with teams, with flight crews flying the planes. And then it's to develop a checklist. Before the surgery starts, you need to go through this checklist as a team, and you have to do it religiously. And they're really simple, straightforward things that sound stupid that everybody should know. Like, everybody has to scrub up. Like, we all have to say out loud, what is the surgery we're about to do? And what part of the body are we operating on? Is it clearly marked? Crazy, right? To think that that's important. They were able to reduce complications, serious complications, by 35%. And mortality, they reduced by 47%. Unbelievable, right? 47%. Yep. So in our book, we actually have a checklist. This is a simplified version of it.
That's great.
Daily progress checklist for managers, because managers have a lot to think about. They do have to think about strategy and competitors, the external environment, what's going on with the economy, what's happening with our suppliers. But they have to spend at least a few minutes each day thinking about what's going on internally with the people who report to them directly. Are those people making progress, or are they having more setbacks than progress? And what can I do to facilitate their progress? What one thing could I do tomorrow or this week to facilitate their progress in their most important work?
That's incredible. No, well, thank you. And we've got a few minutes left. So what are you working on right now? Because you're always working on some awesome research topics. And so what's your area of focus these days?
I am studying attitudes toward and adjustment to retirement.
Love it.
And of course, there's a big component of creativity in that, looking at the creativity of work that people are doing before they retire in their career jobs. And do they find creativity in their activities after retirement? But it goes way, way, way beyond creativity. We've now done 200 interviews with professionals from U.S. companies who are either immediate pre-retirement, or they have retired from those companies in the last few years, or, this is interesting, we've got 12 people out of the 120 we've studied who are going through the retirement transition, and we interview them many times, up to 10 times during that transition. And what I've been working on, like right today, and what I will get back to after we finish this webinar, is analyzing one of my favorite interviewees. I interviewed him 9 times, and going through and deeply analyzing what his experiences were, what was making things work better for him, and what was making that transition difficult.
Interesting. Well, I can't wait. And I'm sure I can't wait to learn more about it. And I guess before I close and talk about our next webinar in a moment, and maybe I'll combine, because I was going to ask you for any final thoughts. And maybe this is really nicely linked with another question from Allison, who says, if there's one piece of advice you would give to me, what would that be? What's like one piece of advice that you would give me? So over to you.
Allison, think about at the end of each day, think about what progress you made and what progress your direct reports and your colleagues made. And if you didn't make the progress that you wanted, if it's lacking in some way, think about those catalysts and nourishers and what you can do to get them for yourself or to help those around you make progress every day.
Love it. Love it. So are there any final thoughts you want to share before I kind of do the official close and announce the next webinar? This has been amazing. I have to say, it's just been such a delight to talk with you. I've had so much fun.
I do want to just share the final thought of just trying to be mindful about these things. You don't have to get wrapped around the axle about it, but you know, I started keeping a diary when I was finishing up this book because I thought, you know, I want to track my own progress in inner work life. And it's been amazing. It's been very, very helpful. I've now got a few years worth of these very short diary entries every day. So I think about doing that, folks.
I love that. Journaling about our experiences, creating a diary and tracking it. So, so powerful. So thank you so, so much. And I just want to say again, thanks so much. I've been a fan, Teresa, of your research. I've cited it again. I said it's a special kind of treat for me because it's just, I've followed your work throughout. Love the progress principle and the findings. And it's had such an impact on audiences and executives that I've coached. And I know there are so many great nuggets today that people can take away. So thank you for your time. I know you've got so much going on. So it really means a lot that you decided to share that with myself and this community.
It was really my pleasure, Craig. Thank you so much. I truly enjoyed it.
Thank you for your time and can't wait to see you again next time.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on Do Good to Lead Well. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Dowden or reach out via LinkedIn or email info@craigdowden.com. I look forward to meeting you here next week for another transformational episode.